And Chip, I bet you have had zero pushback from patients when you're doing an ERG. And in fact, they're like, oh, this is cool. My doctor is taking care of me. I explain it to him as the EKG of the eyes. And it's amazing. All patients know what an EKG is. They just do. Whether they're 35, I had a 37-year-old yesterday, or they were 87 years old. They know what an EKG is. This is the EKG for your eyes. When your cardiologist wants a complete cardiac picture, they take pictures and they do an EKG for function. And we're doing the same thing in CHIP. Patients appreciate that. They're like, wow, that is cool. And they think you're taking better care of me. This doctor's on top of it, and that matters.
Well, hello and welcome to the Chris Wolf Podcast on iCode Media. We're going live again today, and I had the pleasure of talking to Dr. Nate Lighthizer and Dr. Chip Wood. What we wanted to discuss today, and what I really wanted to bring these guys in on, is to talk about the science behind ERGs. We get a ton of questions about how to implement ERG into practice. We get a ton of questions on really what's the evidence behind it? What's the science behind it? And then also probably the most important question, and I want to kind of really work through this today, is how does this change my clinical decision-making? How is this going to change my patient care? I think that's one of the most important things in all of this, but I want to kind of walk us through all of those things. So as always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. We'll put the links in the show notes. Be sure to support those who support us, and please enjoy this conversation. If you have any questions, you can put them in the chat. Our producer will kind of jump in and ask us any of those questions. She'll monitor that chat as we go. But I think that kicks us off, and I think this is a great place to start. So, Nate, you've been on for multiple times. Chip, this is your first time on. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah. I think I'm excited for this. So let's start. You know, Nate, I don't know anybody that geeks out on electrophysiology like you do. So tell me, kind of go into the details of specifically ERG, kind of how does it work? Just give us kind of a crash course refresher. Many of us haven't thought about this since optometry school. So give us a crash course refresher on how it works and why it can tell us things about the retina.
Well, thanks, Chris. And I think that's why we're here, is I want people to start thinking about ERG and realizing that this is not your grandfather's ERG, that things are a lot different in 2024 than they were even in 2010. 14 years ago, I took over as our chief of electrophysiology clinic. Chris, you graduated in 2008 from our program, and you remember the days of dark adapted patients and putting them in the closet and sitting them there for 40 minutes, all patched up, and then having to wheel them out dark adapted and putting things in the eyes. And, you know, that was electrophysiology from 15, 20, 25, 30, 40 years ago. And don't cringe anymore when you think of ERGs. I mean, this testing is so quick now and so portable. And the thing I want people to remember, it is an objective functional test. And we don't have a lot of objective functional tests. We have a lot of objective structural tests. We do dilated fundus exams, and we take fundus photos, and we do OCTs. We're all so familiar with OCT, fundus photo, and DFE. Those are objective. They don't rely on the patient for the most part, and we're looking at structure. We have functional tests. Our main functional test that we think of as an ancillary test would be visual field, but we all know that relies on the patient. It is subjective and looks at function. ERG is an objective test. It doesn't overly rely on the patient, and it's telling us about retinal function. An ERG, objective retinal function. And there's different types of ERGs. There's pattern ERGs, there's multifocal ERGs, there's flash ERGs, flash flicker ERGs. There's all different types of ERGs, and they all do a little bit different things. But the bottom line is the ERG has gone from being very important in the research center to now being very important in the clinical exam lane now, as it's become more patient-friendly, doctor-friendly, staff-friendly. So think of ERG, functional, objective, and we now have handheld devices that we can take right to the patient and do flash ERGs that tell us overall, how is the retina functioning? And that's a big deal. This is not going to replace your OCT. It's not going to replace your fundus photos. It's going to pair with them, which is really nice.
So what I wanted to do, I think that's pertinent, because the two main things, and Chip, you might want to be able to speak to this, but kind of the two main things that that we will encounter, well, I guess two main reasons where we're thinking about common diseases. I want to get to these in a second, but just to sort of explain this a little bit, kind of my mind likes to think about, like, what are we actually seeing as far as reactions go? And where would we apply this to very common diseases? So I want you guys to talk about rare diseases in a second, but when I think about common diseases, one of the things that I think is very helpful, specifically when I get questions about how do we use this in patients with glaucoma, I like to think about, so on your screen here, if you're watching, you should be able to see kind of a poster or an image of a cross-section OCT of the macula. Now, when I usually talk about this, and again, I want to take a departure here because I think this is helpful to think about what it is doing. What are the potentials doing as we're measuring them? And so so the first couple things here is that I think when we look at what's important, we're thinking about mainly the photoreceptors. We're thinking about the stuff in the middle. I like to call that the sensory retina. Often we think about it outer plexiform, inner plexiform, but kind of the sensory retina. And then we have the ganglion cell complex. So when we think about ERGs and what's important with them, obviously we have a couple different waves. So the kind of background behind it is, without geeking out too much, is basically we see a negative response wave, we call the A wave, when the photoreceptors are activated by getting a photon of light. And then we have this B wave, which is sort of the stuff in the middle, the bipolar cells, the inner plexiform, the outer plexiform later, that gives us this positive peak. And then what you'll hear about a lot is this PHNR curve, which is essentially, that's the function of the retinal ganglion cells as that travels the signal from the bipolar cells in through the GCC back to the optic nerve. And so I think when you understand this, it can allow you to understand that there could be dampening at any one of these levels. So if you see a muted area that would be in correspondence with the A wave, that would tell us about the photoreceptors, primarily the cones. If we saw a muted B wave, we'd say, well, maybe there's something that's not functioning very well in the bipolar cells, that stuff in the middle, the sensory retina. And then the ganglion cell, if there's sort of this delay or muted PHNR, photopic negative response curve, then you can see that that we can get things muted. And I only show this to you because when I think about this, mainly for the listener, I think if I understand that these things can be delayed or muted, now I can focus on diseases that exist in those specific patients or in those specific areas of the retina. So is this how you think, Chip, or am I too specific here?
No, that's a great way of thinking about it. You can go very, you know, geeked out scientific and look at that diagnostic part that way. And you're right on with what you said about the photoreceptors versus the inner retinal layer and then the ganglion cell. So thinking about common conditions in a traditional optometric practice, three things that jump out are going to be diabetes, optic nerve disease, and retinal disease. And so what we know is that A wave, the implicit time is another name for that. We want that to be as fast as possible. I always say, like the Olympics, if you're running as fast as you can, you win the race. But if you're really slow, you don't. So when you're looking at that A wave, if you have a reduced A wave or a slow wave that's out of 95% confidence levels, then that means you probably have significant cellular stress, which can correlate with active retinal disease or other conditions there. So I'm in rural Texas. There,
Chip. So just a second, yeah. Chip. I want to dig into that a little bit. So yeah. We get a muted A wave or a delayed A wave. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about retinal disease that would impact the photoreceptors. Is that correct?
That is correct. And so for a diabetic patient, it could be ischemia from diabetic retinopathy or vascular changes. Even for a hypertensive patient, it could be hypertensive background retinopathy. For a patient with ARMD, stress of the macula, it can show up as well. So when you see basically an abnormal A wave, we're thinking that right now in my chair is a patient that's under some type of cellular stress. We think there's an active condition happening right now, most likely at the retinal level, not so much the optic nerve level. So, you know, I'm here in rural Texas today, and we see a ton of patients that have diabetes. So that's really what has been a game changer in my clinic, because we have a lot of patients that we know they have retinopathy, but the question is, how are they doing? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? And yes, we can track fasting blood glucose and hemoglobin A1C levels, but it doesn't always tell us the big picture. So by having this technology, it can kind of let us to grade objectively functional analysis of, are they getting better? Are they getting worse? And also watch their risk for advancing to a higher level of a problem where surgical interventions such as injections might be necessary for DME and things like that. So the A wave is the photoreceptors, and if that's abnormal, we have active stress. Now that B wave you mentioned with the inner retinal cells, if those are abnormal, typically you're gonna have a reduced level, meaning that there's gonna be a longer spread, or a reduction of the amplitude. So when you have a reduced B wave or a reduced amplitude, it's kind of like being weaker. So think about weightlifting. The more you can lift, you're gonna win that gold medal. The less you lift, basically, you're not going to place in the gold. So with this, if you have a lower amplitude or reduced amplitude, that usually means you have some level of cell death. You're losing cells. And that doesn't actively mean that it's happening today. It may have happened in the past, but you get an idea of the status of the overall retinal health. So with that.
In that B wave, when you think about this clinically, when that B wave is muted, maybe that's not the right term, or dampened, that's how I like to think about it. What are the clinical diseases that you would expect to see to dampen that B wave?
Again, you know, a lot of that has to do with the retinal type of images. So again, people that have advanced diabetic retinopathy, hypertensive retinopathy, possibly macular degeneration, other types of background retinopathies as well. So, you know, in our clinic, we're primarily seeing the big three, which is diabetic retinopathy, hypertensive retinopathy, and macular degeneration. And we can use this testing to get functional objective measurements of how are they today, and then also what is their status. And so you're detecting the issue on the initial evaluation, and then basically you're managing it by looking for a change of improvement or worsening. You know, some conditions don't improve, but some conditions do, and it helps you to track and see how that's going. So we're focusing mainly on retina for the A wave and B wave, but then you also mentioned this new thing we're looking at called the PHNR, and that's been very effective for looking at problems with the ganglion cells, which correlates with the optic nerve. So with that, we are looking at anything that can lead to some type of optic neuropathy, whether it be secondary to glaucoma, from non-iridic ischemic optic neuropathy, from traditional just ischemia, any type of optic nerve disease. There is some signs that multiple sclerosis, optic neuritis, you can see some differences there as well. That typically, though, is better seen with VEP. Would you agree with that, Nate?
I would completely agree with that, yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, in my clinic, we do not see a lot of multiple sclerosis and more of the posterior optic nerve diseases. But for the anterior nerve, the glaucoma type issues of ischemia, as well as the NAION, which is significant out here in the rural areas, has been very effective. And the reason it's so important, it gives you initially detection, but then you can follow. And we find out here in rural Texas that a lot of our patients have significant cataracts and they're not running right away to get them fixed. And we know that sometimes our other testing we have, our OCTs and our visual fields, as Nate said, they're subjective testing. They can be affected by a media opacity. For the most part, this test is not affected by media opacity. So we get very good objective functional testing, even when you don't have an ideal media to take the test. So when I've got that patient that I'm questioning myself, I have abnormal NFL findings on an OCT scan, I have abnormal GCC findings on an OCT scan, I can then order the PHNR ERG, and it helps me to figure out, is this nerve as injured as it looks on this other testing? And many times we find the nerve is not as sick as you would think. So it definitely has added a lot to how we manage our patients with diabetes, our patients with hypertensive retinopathy issues, and our patients with optic nerve conditions such as glaucoma, ischemic optic neuropathy, and things like that.
The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, how do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote-unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education, for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com. One of the challenging things with patients is that when they invest in a really high quality pair of glasses and customized lenses, occasionally it can be difficult to keep those lenses clean, scratch-free, and smudge-free. Now, we have the ability with Crizal Sapphire HR lenses to offer our patients a best-in-class anti-reflective coating that is also resistant to scratches, smudges, and deposits. This means that patients spend more time enjoying clear and comfortable vision and less time caring for their lenses. So remember that you can provide patients with the best-in-quality, best-in-class transparency, clarity, durability, and UV protection in a single Crizal coating. If you want to learn more about Crizal Sapphire HR, contact your Essilor account executive or visit EssilorPro.com/Crizal. So tell me why, if I'm remembering correctly, so again, I have to take another crash course. We're going to talk about VEP. But the reason that MS and other posterior optic neuritises would impact a VEP more is because that's going to measure basically the potential as it goes through the rest of the visual pathway. Is that what I'm remembering correctly?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff. Yes.
Okay. So, all right. So with that, I think there's a couple things I want to unpack a bit, Chip, with what you had said. But to me, I think it's interesting because I think we get into this perspective of like, well, if a patient's 20/20, and even though if I identify these other things, then I'm okay. Like 20/20, that's all I need to really understand. But from a vision standpoint, you know, if we think about like heart function, you know, cardiologists don't just listen to heartbeats, right? They do measure lots more about the heartbeat, and they don't just measure like one other thing. They're going to have, you know, things like echocardiograms. They're going to have ultrasounds. They're going to have lots of other tools to assess all the different things that are going on and making sure that things are stable or as you say, improving. So I think you make the case a little bit for me where I'm thinking, you know, I got a patient with 20/20 AMD, but is their visual system functioning normally, right? Like, is it actually normal or are there things that are sick that they actually might have a problem with? Yeah. Same thing with, you know, your case for glaucoma. You know, if we're talking about glaucoma, one of the things I think about in primary care glaucoma, I think, you know, if I say where I would see this really fitting well in is the secondary care, right? The referral center that gets a glaucoma patient or gets hey, you know, Dr. Wolf, is this glaucoma? Or you get a patient that has cataracts and you're thinking, this is a funky looking nerve. Is it the fact that the patient's a 7-diopter myope? Is it because the nerve is twisted or tilted or obliquely inserted? In primary care, we have the ability to wait and watch, right? Like I see that patient, I can look at that looks kind of funky, but it's like, yeah, I think this is because of just weird anatomy as opposed to actual change where they need to make a decision accurately right away. So in primary care, in comprehensive care, Chip, how does this add value when you can watch and wait? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it depending on the condition, it adds value in different ways. And so talking about your patient that has that awkward looking nerve, and let's say it is a patient that basically is at upper in age and they have multiple things going on and they have a very large cup, or they have that twisted nerve, or they have a little bit of pallor and you're not quite sure, okay, what's going on here? And they have maybe a 20/40, 20/50 cataract. And so your visual field has depressions, but it's not a classic pattern. And then you do an OCT and you basically see there's some defects there that don't correlate with the visual field. So you're now thinking, okay, well, what's really going on? That is where this has really added a lot to my clinic, because I'd run for a patient that has a glaucoma or a nerve question, we'll run a specific test called a Redival ERG PHNR, which is going to look at that ganglion cell function, and it will let me know, where is this patient? And you'll get an implicit time reading, you'll get an amplitude reading, that's your A and B wave, and then you get the PHNR reading. And then there's a calculation called a W ratio you get as well, which is a proprietary calculation for optic nerve function. And with that, you'll see where they are. And depending upon the confidence levels and where these things are at, it'll tell you, okay, is this a nerve that's basically doing pretty well and there's a lot of healthy nerve fiber there functioning well? Okay, I'm not as worried about it. And so now you're not as concerned about follow-up, do I start treatment, things like that. Having said that, if you find that they're basically in that 90, 95, 98% confidence level, they're just about outside normal ranges, you're probably a lot more likely to think, okay, we have some type of active condition going on here that we need to manage better, whether it be basically a glaucoma patient where you're lowering pressure if the pressure's up, or whether it's possibly a systemic condition, they don't have good control of their diabetes, their blood pressure, cholesterol, they're overweight, and want to try and basically coordinate with their primary care doctor and other healthcare professionals for better systemic care. And I would say that especially for my patients with diabetes, because we have a ton of that down here in Texas, there's a test we run with this device called the Redival Diabetic Retinopathy ERG. And that's really the one that's really revolutionized the care in my clinics for my diabetic patients. I'm sure Nate in Oklahoma is kind of the same way. Mm-hmm. And with that, we run that test a lot, because anytime we see any retinopathy whatsoever, I want to know today, how are they doing? And the results can be very surprising. And just a real quick, you know, ERG 101 on that. What does that test do? Well, it's a test that it measures the A wave and the B wave. But the Redival technology we're using for our test also measures pupil response. And we know that when someone has more advanced diabetic retinopathy, the ischemia that affects their vision can also affect their pupil function because of iris ischemia. So with that, normal functioning retinas have normal functioning irises typically. And you can see a trend that the more advanced the diabetic retinopathy ischemia is, the more reduced the pupil function is. So with that, the Redival device will measure A wave, B wave, and pupil response. So it's important to do that test when they're not dilated. That's critical for the diabetic ERG. With that data, we then will get what's called a diabetic retinopathy score. And that's really changing how I manage my patients and giving them better quality of care. Because studies were done, and what they found was that if you take the best A wave from the eye with the better A wave and the better B wave, and then the worst eye pupil response, and then factor in age of the patient, with those four parameters, you'll get what's called a diabetic retinopathy score. And what they found was that if you have a patient that has a diabetic retinopathy score of 23.5 or higher, and they have severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy or worse, there is a 65% or higher chance that they're going to have some type of interventional retinal procedure in the next 3 years. And if that number is over 26, then basically it's probably within 1 year. But the good news is the primary care eye care provider, if you're trying to decide, do I need to refer this patient or not, the study also confirmed if they have a test score under 23.5, there is a minimal chance, 20% or less, that they're going to basically progress to needing surgical intervention within 3 years. So when you're sitting there going, okay, well, I see moderate diabetic retinopathy. I did my OCT. There's no DME there. And that's a primary indicator for referral. Am I comfortable where this patient's at right now? So now by having this new test score called a diabetic retinopathy ERG score, if the patient has an 18 score, that's a low risk for significant progression to needing surgical intervention within the next 3 years. But if they're a 22 or higher.
So just a second, Chip, just a second. So you're using a patient where if you look at our clinical practice guidelines, that moderate patient with no DME, basically they're saying, watch this patient every 6 months. But if you're about ready to say that if your score is 22 or maybe 22.5, I can't remember what you're, I don't know what you're going
to
say.
It's closer to 23.5, which is the magic number.
So then if you hit that 23.5 and you got a patient with moderate, non-proliferative, no DME, you maybe instead of watching that patient every 6 months, now you're going to change your protocol and follow them a little closer. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'll probably bring him back at 3 months, excuse me. And I'll also have a heart-to-heart conversation with where we are. And what I'm finding is that a lot of patients walk in and don't know what their hemoglobin A1C was, their last test, or their fasting blood glucose. They just know, they said it was okay, or it was kind of borderline, or I have to do something. But now we can tell them that, you know what, based upon our findings today, with say a 22 ERG score today, you're at high risk that if we don't get something under better control, you might start having significant vision problems in the very near future. What I find is that when I give them that information and tell them the risk and the path they're on, they tend to basically self-engage better with their own self-care and take more responsibility.
Will you see that number decline? Like as their A1C declines and improves, you'll see that number as well.
Absolutely. And Nate, you comment on this too, but I find there's a delayed response. And so what will happen is that let's say that 6 months ago, they were a 12.0 A1C and they were not doing very well. We have ischemic issues, but peripheral neuropathy, probably some kidney issues. And now we have some retinopathy. So maybe they're on Ozempic now, and maybe they had a lap band procedure. And now all of a sudden they went from a 12 to a 9 and now they're at a 7. So all of a sudden you look back there and you say, hey, you did have moderate or severe findings before, but now I only see a few little dot and blot hemorrhages. It looks great. It looks good. But they still tell you, hey, doc, my night vision is still terrible. I really don't feel safe driving at night. Well, you run the test and find they still have an abnormal diabetic retinopathy ERG. Why? Well, because, the eye is healing itself because there's less stress going on, but they still have the ischemia that has to kind of heal itself as well. And I've had some patients like that. They're like, looks pretty good. I see a few blot hemorrhages, do a little test and it's abnormal. And they go, well, doc, you're right. I mean, 6 months ago it was 12.0 or what have you. So it does lag a little bit as far as the retina gets healthier, but you will see it. And with the ERG score, if it basically improves, then that's great. If it increases, for every point it increases, you can have a doubling or a tripling or a quadrupling of the risk that they might need intervention in the near future. So you're detecting it on day one, and then you're managing over the course of time as well. And that's really helped my patients to basically self-engage with their own care. It's opened up new dialogue with primary care doctors and endocrinologists to get better care management as well. And I'm sure Nate's doing a lot of great things in his clinic as well.
Yeah, I think Nate, what's interesting to me is you know, obviously we have rural Texas, we have Oklahoma and hospital system Oklahoma.
Yep.
You know, and IHS hospital system in Oklahoma. It would seem to me that there's probably a lot of potential upside related to your patients with diabetes, and even just the communication that goes back and forth with the primary care doctors. But you know, I remember when I was being trained, it was really challenging because, you know, one, you're seeing patients back, you're following protocols. It's still challenging, but you're, you know, in eye care, it can seem as though we're just reporting findings, right? We're a little disengaged, even though we're kind of reinforcing what the patient ought to do from their primary care doctor. it would seem, you know, based on what Chip is saying, is that this could become another portion of, you know, leading or lagging what we might see with an A1C. What's going on with the IHS and your patient population related to diabetes?
Yeah, we use this a ton. I did 9 of these yesterday morning. That's why when Chip was talking, I was looking over here, I was pulling up. I don't know if I can share my screen or not, Chris. Can I do that or not?
There might be a little function. Do you have a share function on the bottom?
Yeah, I'm going to share my screen. And can you guys see my screen?
Nope. There we go. Yep, yeah. It's coming up.
You know, this was... I did 9 of them yesterday morning, but you just look at the difference between this patient that has diabetes, and Chip knows this. You look at this, and overall, this is a very, very good looking ERG. As Chip said, you've got a diabetic retinopathy score of 15.8. The lower the number, the better. You know, he highlighted 23.5 as kind of the cutoff. You get above 23.5, and you are at a much greater risk of progressing. You know, look at the difference between this ERG, 15.8. We've got nice waveforms here. Everything is in the normal range. Nice pupillary response versus the next patient that has
now,
an ERG.
Hold on a second, Nate. Yep. What did that retina look like? What did that patient's retina look like?
Yeah, this patient had had mild non-proliferative retinopathy, a couple small microaneurysms here and there. And you look at this and you go, Chip, I'm feeling pretty darn good when you have a retina that is functioning like this. Mrs. Jones, you're doing great. You need to control your blood sugar. You're doing that. A1C was actually decently well. It was like 7.1 on this one. But I'm feeling good. We can see you back in a year. You still control your blood sugar and your blood pressure, but we're looking good at this point. It gives you confidence. Knowledge is power. We all know that, right? And we've got the structure. We've got the function, and I'm feeling good as a provider that we are providing the best care for this patient by having a structural picture and a functional picture as well.
Well, and as you pull up the next one, I mean, if you were going to pull up somebody else, I think you might have been. But as you do that, you know, a couple things comes to mind as, you know, we do like greens and yellows and reds. That's what has gotten us to the point of feeling comfortable about different things. And I think that's really helpful as you learn technology. So like now when I look at an OCT or I look at a visual field, you know, I'm never looking at greens and reds. I mean, I'll look at them, but like I my analysis goes deeper than that. But it brings you into comfort, right? At first, it brings you into comfort, and then it gives you an ability to say, well, what's a normal look like? So I think, you know, that's a really nice thing. But what you're demonstrating right away is like, I can look at this and be like, yep, something's not right. But then as you look at this, it's going to get even deeper than just your greens and reds, because then you're looking at symmetry. But things might all be green, but there might be some asymmetry between the right and the left. And so that's what I think is great about some of the newer technology that we have. I don't remember ever getting green and red printouts from our old ERGs and VEPs that we had to suffer through, Nate.
And that's that is such an important point that Chip made and that you just followed up on is – you know, we can dive into the electrodiagnostic weeds and talk about A waves from photoreceptors and B waves from the midretinal layers or the sensory retina and the photopic negative response. The beauty now is we have a device that has protocols that we just select the photopic negative response protocol, and that's what we're doing then. We don't have to look at these lines that are kind of wiggling everywhere and going, is this A wave more reduced, or is this B wave, or is this photopic negative response? We've got the diabetic retinopathy protocol. That's what I chose 8 of the 9 times yesterday. I've got a diabetic patient, and I'm going to do the DR protocol, so I have the DR score as you're seeing the printout as you're seeing on the screen here. Or I've got a glaucoma patient, I'm going to do the photopic negative response. Chris, when you were in school from 2004 to 2008, that wasn't the way it is. When I took over in 2010, that's not the way it was. You could just order an ERG, and then you had to read and interpret these squiggly lines going everywhere, which was darn hard. We had no normative databases. We had no numbers. It was just looking at this, trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about this patient. What did the retina look like? Give me some background.
So this patient had severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, was not proliferative yet, but severe in both eyes. A1C was way out of whack. And I mean, Chip, you know, Chris, you guys know this. You just said it, Chip. You've got a patient that's got severe NPDR, and look at the difference. The last one I showed you had a diabetic retinopathy score of like 15.8. That's great. The lower the number, the better. 23.5 is the cutoff. Lower the better. If it's in the teens, for the most part, I'm very happy. I want to see it in the teens. And look at this one, 32.0. Very, very elevated score. Why is it elevated? The pupillary response is not as good. Look how the amplitude and I don't know if you guys can see my, can you see my cursor wiggling here?
Yep, sure.
These peaks are supposed to be in these boxes. This ERG is slow and weak. I love Chip's analogy of a runner in the Olympics. You want to be fast, not slow, and a weightlifter. I tell my patients and my students and residents, I want my ERG like my athletes, strong and quick. Strong and quick, not weak and slow. And this ERG is weak and slow, and this patient is in trouble. I tell them, I'm like, you're going towards the cliff and we're getting close to the cliff, and we need to, you know, we need to do everything we can to back you away from the cliff, because there's a high likelihood of needing intervention very, very soon in this patient. Chip?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, you see this when you get scared to death, you try and get them to own their health and to take responsibility and to understand that it's not just diet and exercise and medication that's important, but it's also basically understanding that this is a chronic progressive condition that has to be managed every single day of your life, or bad things can happen. And you know, we're concerned about vision, but we got to think about other things, you know, kidney failure, dialysis 3 days a week, you know, neuropathies where they have no mobility anymore, and they, you know, amputations. And there's just so many so sad complications that happen with this. And we have a unique a privilege and ability to help them to recognize these challenges and do something about it. And with that patient, though it looks very, very horrible for them, you know, in combination with coordination of care with the eye doctors like ourselves, as well as the PCPs, endocrinologists, whoever's working with them, there's a chance they can turn that around and make it better. And but that was a sick eye, obviously.
Yeah. And here's another one. I unshared my screen and shared another one. Now, let me not fool you. The most of the time when you do these on your patients with diabetes, you're not getting a score of 32 or 30. Chip knows that. 7 of the 9 that I did yesterday were good. They were where I wanted them to be, in the teens or the very low 20s. I've now showed you both of the ones that were significantly elevated. I brought this one up because you look at this and can you see the asymmetry between the right eye and the left eye? It's very clear to see which eye has a weaker retinal response. I better take a little bit closer look at that left eye, looking for any neovascularization. What's going on there? Now, that's not great in either eye. This is slow and weak over here, and this is even slower and weaker over here. But again, knowledge is power, and it gives you what's going on retinal function-wise, as well as your structural test. So again, clearly can see the asymmetry in this patient.
Yeah,
I think this is... This tells me a lot about what's going on from a retinal perspective and in terms of function. And I can definitely see where this fits in my practice. So I want to kind of fill this into another kind of realm, and one that we see a lot of docs struggle with. And I, you know, I could go into the my suspicion of the psychology behind it, but I'll spare the listeners this episode with that. But one of the things that I see is that, you know, I am not a fan of chasing, of just going, well, I'm not a fan of just blanket screening, with things that are relatively, you know, where you have to chase stuff. I'm not afraid of chasing things, just like, but I think one of the challenges that our profession fits into is that we buy stuff and then we use it as a screening device. And what I'm hearing you both talk about here is you're using other technology for us to evaluate that are better at filtering out, maybe not better is the right word, but but basically allowing us to focus our efforts. I don't hear a lot of, we just run this test on every single patient over this age and just see what happens. So I really like that aspect of it. But when you go away from this idea of screening and detecting, unfortunately, within our profession is they're having a hard time thinking about how do I use this and when do I do it? So Chip and well, Dr. Wood and Dr. Lighthizer, tell me, when you order this test, as far as your patient flow goes in, do you know, like, are you ordering it on the previous exam? Like, you know, okay, this patient's got diabetes. I see some retinopathy. I'm going to capture that image now, or I'm going to capture that information now. Or once I see this, it's like, look, I've got a cadence that I want to see. If I'm seeing this patient every 3 months because of their risk or every 6 months because of their risk, we're going to get this image or this, I keep calling it an image. This piece of information. I mean, tell me how you're integrating it into your practice, and am I missing something with not wanting to use this as a screener?
I completely agree with that. I mean, this is a medical diagnostic test, and my opinion is that it should be used for medical diagnostic testing, not as a screening tool. Now, can it be a screening tool? It can be, but realistically, it's looking more at more significant retinal disease or optic nerve disease. So protocols in our clinic basically is not to do it as a screening tool. And so a typical scenario, patient comes into our clinic, we basically do a comprehensive eye examination. If they have a history of diabetes, we're going to do an OptiMap or an ultra-wide field retinal scan. We're going to do basically a dilated examination. And if we find with that this is a type 1 or type 2 diabetic patient with some level of retinopathy, then that is the initial kicker to start this type of technology for evaluation. In the same way with my comprehensive exam for a patient that does not have a systemic condition, but they have eye pressures over 20, or they have asymmetry of their optic nerve cupping, or they have large optic nerve cupping, that's now someone who's at risk for some type of optic neuropathy, whether you call them a glaucoma suspect or otherwise. And so we'll bring them back for testing, and part of our testing will be this. And the beauty of the Retival ERG being so small and so quick and so easy to do is that for a optic nerve question or a retinal condition such as a macular degeneration question, you can do that test with or without dilation. So there are situations where I didn't order the test coming into the clinic, but during the evaluation, I said, oh, I'm seeing a significant drusen in this side of the eye, or I see significant vessel tortuosity in just one eye. Maybe we're concerned about carotid artery stenosis or something like that. So you can order it on the fly. And I find that in most cases, it takes less than 5 minutes from setup to completion. And in most times, the patient's walking out the door before I finish my chart notes. It's a very fast test. So it's easy to do it as a, let's order it today while they're here. The one exception is the diabetic retinopathy test. And so since a new patient is being pre-dilated before I see them, that's going to cause their pupil responses not to be reliable, which is a big part of that score we talked about. So for my diabetic patients, if I see retinopathy, I will then basically have them come back in the near future, next couple of days, and I'll just do a tech visit. And we'll get that test done to add to my initial findings. And based upon the findings, we'll then decide, okay, is this a 3-month follow-up, 6-month follow-up, or 1-year follow-up based upon level of retinopathy, level of score, and then how is her A1C and sugars and risk for possible problems. So I don't screen, I don't encourage screening, but I absolutely use it a lot once we have a need for that for our patients that have retinopathy under optic nerve questions. What are y'all doing in Oklahoma?
Nate, are you finding that you're I hear, and I love your approach, Chip. I think the other thing about that is, you know, for people to wrap their minds around a schedule, you know, I think it's really kind of helpful to think about, you know, you have your comprehensive exam. What does that actually mean? What are you doing for that comprehensive exam? And then you have your other problem focused examinations that are diving deeper into that disease state at whatever interval is clinically appropriate. And then also using a technician. So, I mean, just to point out something, right? If we were seeing a patient, a comprehensive exam patient, and I'll even just say, and Nate, you can respond to this as well. I'll say that we're spending 20 minutes on a comprehensive exam. If you look at the data, that's actually a lot of us think we're spending 20 minutes, but we're not delivering care at a clip of 20 minutes. Usually, if you look at data, it's closer to every half hour on average. But let's say that it was 20 minutes is what everybody thinks they are doing. Then then what are we doing within that 20 minutes? And then what else can we do? Like, if you're thinking about, if I get to walk in on a patient who has diabetes and I'm seeing them back outside of their comprehensive exam and we have ultra wide field imaging, maybe we get this test first because we've ordered it before, this test, ultra wide field image, DFE, and I haven't even pressures DFE. I haven't even seen the patient yet. I can walk in and know, is their retina looking better or worse? Is their retina functioning better or worse? And I can just talk to the patient at that point based on our, I mean, again, like talk about levels of codes. People think that they still have to, like, I have to dilate. I have to do all these elements of examination. I have to do all these review of systems and pass. No, you just get to take care of the patient. So what that's going to look like is I get to sit down now and have maybe a 5 to 10 minute conversation with a patient. Yeah, I might be examining some other things, but I'm just reinforcing messages, trying to find out, like, maybe even pain points that they have. Like, hey, doc, I'm really having a hard time getting out and doing X, Y, and Z. Well, now I get to have, I mean, I do get to have that relationship with the patient, but it doesn't, the point there is it doesn't have to take that 20 minute clip. And if I am strategic about my schedule, I might have a 20 minute exam slot here, but then a 10 minute, you know, kind of saddling slot where I can come in and see and have, and really deliver excellent care and dive deeper into that stuff, which I think is, I wanted to make that point because I think, Chip, that allows people to kind of wrap their minds around it, where you have a technician that's efficient and you're not having to do a lot of the work, right? So Nate, when you think about that, you know, you're in a little different clinical setting, definitely busy, but you are kind of running and overseeing a lot of other student doctors at the same time in residents. So, are you differing there with some of this stuff?
We're similar and different. You know, we, as you remember, we have diabetic clinic and we have glaucoma clinic and we have ocular disease clinic, which is other types of eye disease. And we have dry eye clinic and laser clinic. So like when I went to clinic yesterday morning, I had 4 fourth year students and a resident and myself. And so we had 12 diabetic patients scheduled yesterday morning. We had a couple other things that we had to do as well, but I was there knowing I was going to see diabetic patients all morning. And the beauty about this is when it's portable and it's handheld, my goodness, it doesn't affect your flow really at all. Like, you walk in and you clean here for just a couple of seconds, you put the electrodes on, and the test, the DR protocol with a DR score, is literally a minute in each eye, less than a minute. It is very, very quick. We have found that it hasn't affected our flow really at all, because you just walk in. It's like doing anything else. To me, it's even quicker than getting an OCT now, because now you got to have Mrs. Jones slowly get up out of the chair, slowly walk to another room. You sit down, you clean the instrument. By the time you get the protocol, I mean, it's quicker to do an ERG now than it is to do fundus photos and OCT. And that is vastly different than it was even 5 to 10 years ago. So for flow, it's been much better. And we've really, really liked that. So yeah, that'd be my thoughts on that.
The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, how do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote-unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education, for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com. Young and emerging presbyopes can be tricky. These patients want and need additional help at near, but they can be resistant to solutions that create even mild distance blur. The MyDay multifocal lens has been great for our presbyopic patients. It allows those patients to transition into a multifocal more easily. We've had this lens now for long enough that we've been able to see how simple transitions can be from an adaptation standpoint, from lower ad designs to higher ad designs. The MyDay multifocal material is Cooper Vision's softest one-day hydrogel lens and features Aquaform technology combining the unique balance of high oxygen permeability with natural wettability in one material. The result is a highly breathable lens that keeps our patients' eyes looking clear, white, and healthy. So if you haven't started utilizing MyDay multifocal in your practice, I'd encourage you to reach out to your Cooper Vision representative to get started.
Yeah.
So then let me kind of bring this full circle. I actually thought we were going to have a conversation here earlier about this, but I'm kind of still interested in it. Nate, what are the zebras that I get to use an ERG and a VEP for?
Yeah, I mean, we always think horses and zebras, and Chip, you know, beautifully covered the horses of your diabetes, diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, macular degeneration. But don't forget about those more rare things, your vein occlusions, your retinal vascular disease, ocular ischemic syndrome. That I wish I had it in front of me. It was sitting right there, and Dr. Whittle grabbed it out. I bring this and I look and I go, Chris, you remember what it used to look like. It looked like a big visual field, the big bowl, right? And you had a six-step ISEV protocol, the international, you know, classification of electrophysiology and vision, those standards. And I'm diving into the electrodiagnostic swamp right now. But my point is it that huge instrument had step one, the scotopic rod response, and step two, the scotopic rods and cones, and step three, the oscillatory potentials, and then you light adapted to get to the photopic ERG. That little powerful handheld device, yes, you're most likely going to use it with the DR protocol. That's going to be number one, and your photopic negative response. But if you wanted to do all of that stuff, there's like 60 plus protocols. Dr. Whittle and I were like kids in a candy store. We were giggling when we were going through all the protocols going, oh, there's the ISEV four-step protocol and the five-step protocol and the six-step protocol. So if you wanted to test a patient that had a rod dystrophy or a cone dystrophy or retinitis pigmentosa, or maybe you were trying to figure out, man, this patient keeps saying they can't see anything at night. Is there something there or is there not something there? You can test just the rods if you want to, or just the cones if they have color vision issues or things like that. So you can dive into a lot of those more rare conditions. Yes, diabetes and glaucoma and AMD are going to be your bread and butter, but you can help a lot of other patients as well that have more of the zebras.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so the last question, what am I missing? So Chip, what am I missing that I haven't thought through that you'd say, Chris, you should really consider this. Your listeners should be thinking about this related to, and I'll give that question to both of you. Really be thinking about this related to ERG today that we haven't covered yet.
Yeah. In a primary care clinic, what I find is that when I graduated 30 years ago, I don't look like I did, but anyways, we didn't have OCTs back then. Okay.
We all had more hair back then, Chip.
Exactly.
All of us.
And so when the OCT came out in the early 2000s and there's lots of vendors, and it was in its infancy. And back then it was a special thing that only a few offices had, but then eventually, in my opinion, it's now standard of care. And when I found this technology with the handheld ERG with the ReadyVal device, I'm like, this is kind of like the OCT was 20 years ago. This is going to eventually be a tool that we need in our office every day to manage our patients that have these different levels of diseases. And so that's what kind of brought me to it. And so with that, I would tell you that, you know, Chris, if your goal, and I know it is to practice at the highest level of independent primary care optometry that you can, both vision and medical eye care, then this is a tool you need, because you're going to be able to better manage your patients that have retinopathies and optic neuropathies by not only detecting the condition, but assessing the condition and then managing the condition and you can follow over time to see, is my treatment improving the situation or is it not improving the situation? And you said earlier about the diabetic patient, you can look and say, okay, there's an extra heme this time compared to last time, but did the function change? And, you know, visual acuity, yes, that's just the central part, though. You can still have significant peripheral night vision challenges. And that prompts a lot of our testing as they come in saying, yeah, I'm seeing pretty good with my glasses, but I really struggle at night. And for those patients, we'll find they often have abnormal amplitudes or implicit times with their testing. So with that, I think that we might be missing a little bit if we're only focusing on visual acuity. And then if we're using peripheral vision testing, wide field fundus photography and OCT, but we're not getting reliable results because of just the patient's not a good tester or there's a media opacity affecting it, this now gives us an objective functional test to have a higher level of managing our patients. So I can't imagine not practicing with it. I have it in both of my offices. And we, like Nate said, we use it several times a day. And I think it's making me a better doctor and better caregiver by having it.
Well, and Chris and Chip, you guys both know the answer to this. Do we like making patients happy? What's the answer to that? It's an obvious
yes. That's all we care about. That's almost all we care about, Nate. I won't go as in depth, but that's almost all we care about is we just want to make people happy.
And Chip, I bet you have had zero pushback from patients when you're doing an ERG. And in fact, they're like, oh, this is cool. My doctor is taking care of me. I explain it to him as the EKG of the eyes. And it's amazing. All patients know what an EKG is. They just do. Whether they're 35, I had a 37-year-old yesterday, or they were 87 years old. They know what an EKG is. This is the EKG for your eyes. When your cardiologist wants a complete cardiac picture, they take pictures and they do an EKG for function. And we're doing the same thing in CHIP. Patients appreciate that. They're like, wow, that is cool. And they think you're taking better care of me. This doctor is on top of it. And that matters.
I agree with that.
I think it absolutely builds, you know, when you do care about patients, right, you will make them happy. And so again, if you care about their well-being, if you care about the way they see, and you care about them like to the fullest extent, and you believe that there's nobody better to take care of their vision and their eye health than you will make the patient happy, right? And so you don't have to worry or wonder, like, am I going to do something that's going to make them happy? You just know you will. And so I think that's a great point, Nate. And I get probably overstated, but I do think one of the biggest concerns that our profession has is maybe not, you know, outside of do they see well and are they going to be, you know, have good ocular health? It is, you know, am I going to make somebody mad? It's maybe even more concerned about making them mad than making them happy. But I think that's a huge factor in the things that we do. I want to go to listener questions. So we do have some currently. So this is one. Chip, do you do an ERG pre-surgical evaluation on cataract patients if vision is impaired and difficulty seeing the retina and the optic nerve clearly?
So our protocol for a cataract patient, basically, we do a visual field screening as part of our normal workup. And then if we think they need cataract surgery, we'll do an OCT just to make sure there's no maculopathy that we're just not able to see. If I don't feel like the visual field is reliable, and if I don't feel like the OCT is reliable, then yes, I'll do basically a ready eval. If the patient has diabetes, I'll order the diabetic ERG test. If they don't have diabetes or a significant hypertensive situation, then I'll order the 16 flicker test. Or if it's a really dense cataract, like a 20/60, 20/70 cataract, there's a 32 flicker that's more intense. And so then that's just one more test to get more data so we know that we can have better outcomes, you know, a post-surgical response that's better. So I would say that it's not my protocol for every patient, but we do use it if the other protocol tests are not reliable.
I got another one. That's great. Thank you. I got another one here. Dr. Lighthizer, I'm looking at my other part of the screen. Let me get there. Have you had a situation, I'm trying to understand this question. So do you have you had a situation where you have pulled a patient off of medications or a patient that you've that you performed an SLT on in the past where you look at this information now and you're not as concerned or the patient you're convinced they don't have glaucoma anymore? Has that ever gone the other direction where you're instead of diagnosing early, now you can take a step back and be like, hey, we don't have to treat anymore?
I'm trying to understand that question as well. So yeah, you've done an SLT.
I think the question is previously the patient had been diagnosed with glaucoma. And mm-hmm. so they had some sort of intervention. Maybe it was surgical, maybe it was topical. But mm-hmm. the results now that you get from, you know, a nerve that looks unusual, that has visual field defects, but you're like, wait a minute, now that we have this piece of information, we can reverse course in the treatment, right? We can take you off of medications. Has that ever occurred in your practice?
Yeah, we've seen improvements in the ERG post-treatment as well. I mean, the answer like that with anything else, I was talking to my good friend down the hall, Dr. Jeff Miller, who you know, is it depends. It's going to depend in glaucoma. What's the stage of the visual field defect, the stage of the glaucoma, the other testing, the pressures, the age of the patient, et cetera, et cetera. So, but have I seen normal photopic negative response ERG results that made me feel better about that and maybe able to peel off a medication? Yes. You know, are we going to go from three meds to zero? No. In severe glaucoma, are we going to do that? No. But again, it gives you that power, that knowledge to say, boy, I'm feeling pretty good because our photopic negative response, our ganglion cell function is looking strong at this point. And patients struggling with compliance, let's go ahead and peel off a medication and see how they do at that kind of reset baseline. So yeah, that has happened before in our clinic.
That's where I would see, like, again, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and this kind of wraps up the conversation is, and we've talked about it throughout here, but it's where else is this going to change my clinical practice? And so, you know, obviously like the early stuff, that makes some sense to me. But I think that there's patients. I mean, there was a study that came out recently that suggested that perhaps, and it's not optometry or ophthalmology, it's all across the board, that we may be over-treating. We may be too aggressive on some patients with glaucoma. And so we may be not just collectively as eye care, like, do we have to be as aggressive as we are? And a lot of times that's the question, you know, like, one, you can't know how good of a doctor you are for your patients who have glaucoma until the end of your career. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you see these patients where, you know, they're suspicious and I become a little bit more hesitant to pull them off medications that somebody else has prescribed for them. But this gives me an idea of where, like, yeah, it could be another point where I would say, listen, we may not need this medication. We may not need this treatment. We could pull you off and see what happens. I might be more confident in that. And I think that can be a big time game changer, especially when, and Nate, you and I have talked about SLT at length, but especially when you look at prostaglandin patients that have been on it now for 20 years. And like, I find myself managing their ocular surface more than managing their glaucoma. Yeah. And so anyway, it's not that medications are bad. It's just like, it gives you another idea of how this can change the way you'd approach these patients.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing, Chris, and it slipped my mind as I was talking on other things of, I do believe that we probably over-treat glaucoma as a whole. Like, if you look at it, I can't tell you the number of patients that I have taken off of therapy, not just because of the ERG, that in part, but for other reasons as well. Yeah, I mean, we're looking for progression over time in all of these tests, whether it's visual field, OCT, ERG. Beauty about ERGs, you can see improvement. So I completely agree with that recent study going, I think sometimes we probably over-treat glaucoma. And this is another tool along with our other tools in our toolbox to help better our decision-making. We learn all the time, don't we?
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So listen, hey, I'll be respectful of your time. Dr. Nate Lighthizer, Dr. Chip Wood, thanks so much for being on and talking about this. I'll tell you, I mean, I think I've exhausted my list of questions. I hope this was helpful for the listeners. You can please feel free to reach out to me, to reach out to Dr. Wood, to Dr. Lighthizer. Everybody that's been on today, thanks so much for being on, and we'll see you guys on the next one.